All right. I went into Double Days to see how many of my books were on the shelves. Then I went to B. Dalton's, and they had more than Double Day. And then I walked past St. Thomas, and then I turned right and came down two blocks and came into your studio.
Roy Blunt, who is a humorist, I'm sure you've
read. Yes, I've read him.
He's a neighbor of mine, in that he lives a couple of blocks away on the west side. But he also goes into the bookstore to see how the books are selling. And he has a theory that a watched book never sells.
Oh, how wonderful.
That's his phrase, a watched book will never sell. So he tries not to to watch his books. He did a very funny little routine with me when he had his latest collection of anecdotes out, and he would go into a bookstore to see if his book is there, his new book, and if it's not, you know, he wants to go up to the clerk and ask for the book, but he doesn't want to buy it.
Yeah.
he's already written it, he doesn't want to buy it, but he wants the clerk to it becomes very, very complicated to go and say, well, do you have such and such by Roy Blunt? And the clerk would say, oh yeah, we have that in the basement.
Well, that's fine. Then you can say, okay, I'll go down there. But what if they say, here it is over there. How many would you like?
Yeah, it's very difficult. It becomes very, very awkward. I certainly enjoyed your work, and I can tell you that I think one of the best compliments that a reader can offer a writer is that you want to read more. And so I've been going back, getting books. I found this one in a secondhand bookshop.
Oh, that's hard to find.
Yeah, and so I want to read more of your stuff. I just haven't read enough, and I've enjoyed what I've read up to this point, but you have more that I still have on my list that I want to read. At any rate, thank you very much for coming in. I appreciate it. I'm glad we were able to get together. I'm going to ask a couple of questions about the finishing school and also about yourself. You were born in Alabama and raised in Asheville.
That's right.
So I guess you have kind of a Tom Wolfe legacy, huh?
I did. I was born in Alabama simply because my mother was visiting her cousins there. So I can't really be claimed by them, although I'm happy to be claimed by them. And then we went back to Asheville, and I grew up there. And the people in Tom Wolfe's books still walk the streets. And, in fact, I believe some of my relatives had cameo parts in Look Homeward, Angel. They say in Asheville when Look Homeward, Angel was published, there was a carbon copy type list of who was who, and it was selling for $10. And in those days, I think a book was what? $2 or $3. So it was selling for three times what the novel was selling. It identified who the characters were in the book.
That's a little dangerous.
Yeah.
I'm not so sure I would like that if I were a writer. I was talking to a young writer also from the South, also born in Alabama. His name is Mark Childress.
I'm reading his book right now, World Made of Fire.
World Made of Fire. And he was born, I can't remember the name of the town, born in the town that Harper Lee was born in.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the name of the town?
No, I don't.
But he said being born in that town was like being born in the town that he gave me some football examples. Joe Namath was born in.
Uh-huh.
Nobody wanted to play football there. Everybody wanted to write.
Yeah.
Was it that way in Asheville at all?
It was, what, you mean everybody wanted to write or nobody wanted to write?
Well, maybe not everybody wanted to write, but obviously there was a literary history there that made people aware of the written word.
There was very much. My mother was a reporter for the Asheville Citizen Times during the war, and one of her assignments was that every time Julia Wolfe remembered something else about Tom, my mother had to get in her car and go over there and take her notebook and write it down. So we were all very much aware that our town had been fictionalized, and when it came time for me to write, I did leave. I wasn't about to start competing with him. He had done everything. He'd done the streets, the mountains. Now, of course, there's a whole new kind of Asheville coming in, so I could afford to do a mother and two daughters and make his Altamount into my mountain city. But it was a scary influence to have hanging over you. He was quite a giant. And even when I did finally publish a novel and was asked back to read at the library, the room I was reading in had a huge portrait of him staring down right over my left shoulder. So there's no getting away from it.
Well, and your mother also a journalist, so I guess you followed a family tradition.
She was a journalist, or she's still alive, and she also wrote short stories, and she'd write two every weekend in her spare time and then send them off. They were love stories. And then she'd send them to New York, and then she'd get a check back in the mail. So I thought this is what, you know, every woman did in her spare time. So I had no problems there.
Not a bad thing to do, either.
No.
You studied journalism.
I studied journalism at the University of North Carolina. And my first job was as a journalist on the Miami Herald.
I was reading the publicist sent me a People magazine article in which you were separated from the Miami Herald for embellishing stories. What was all that about?
It wasn't that exactly. It was just that I had a very hard time writing a boring story. So if I could find some way to put a little energy in it, I would. And one of my beats was the Port Authority, which for a 22-year-old girl is kind of boring. It's these old men sitting around. Well, they weren't so old, but I thought they were. Sitting around talking about tonnage and berths and what ship was coming in next week. And so one afternoon, they seemed to be a little edgy with each other, and one man got up and stalked out. So I wrote Mr. McGonagall, or whatever his name was, stalks out of Port Authority meeting. That was my headline. I even got to write that, and it got in. And he called the paper, and he said, I know she's an eager beaver, and she wants to make something happen, but I was just going to the bathroom. I just stepped out to go to the bathroom. So that was the worst one, actually.
That doesn't sound so bad to me.
Well, there were a few more.
I remember when I was a young journalist in broadcasting in the late 50s, early 60s, and I was working in a small town in Pennsylvania, and the city lawyer was a rather large man that I learned to detest. And I think his name was Judson Hughes. And so every time I would write a story and go on the air with it, I would call him the portly Judson.
Oh, boy. I bet he
And that didn't go over well at all. You know, finally the station manager called me in, and there was a conference, and I had the dictionary with me, and portly did not just mean fat. Portly can also mean gregarious.
Oh.
Spreading one's will and this sort of thing. So I said, that's what it really means. No, Swain, you're not going to get away with that.
Oh, no.
You, what happened after the Miami Herald? What'd you do then?
Well, I left the country as soon as possible. I worked that summer as a waitress to get some money, and then I went to Europe. And I stayed gone for about 5 years and worked. The main job I had, it was a very good one. It was with the American Embassy in London with their tourist office. It was called the U.S. Travel Service. And we advised English people about what to see when they came to America. So I did that. And then when they didn't come in, some days we didn't have many people come in. And I had a nice typewriter there, and I wrote, I wrote a novel at the office.
That wasn't The Perfectionist.
No, it was a novel that I've lost because I did something very foolish. I had one copy of it. Can you believe this? And I showed it to some publishers in London, and they said it was promising, but no. So I saw an ad in the paper, and it said looking for manuscripts with some love interest. And it had some love interest, but it was mostly about divorce. So I sent it off to this address, and it didn't come back, and it didn't come back. Now, this is really a true story. And so finally I called, and there was no answer. And I got into a taxi and went over there, and whoever had rented that office had moved out. There was no one there. So I don't know where that manuscript is, but if it's ever printed under another name, I'll recognize it.
Probably was. Was this in London?
It was in London, and it was in 1964, and the last line of the book wasn't very good. It said something like, if I can do it once, I can do it again. Thus rises the indestructible pyramid. So if you ever read a book that ends like that, that's mine.
I'll look at the back page of every anonymous-looking novel I can find. What was the name of that book?
It was called Gull Key. It was the name of an island on which this couple was very unhappy.
Why didn't you do what Lucy Freeman did? She's a San Francisco novelist, and she wrote a novel about 25 years before her very first one was actually published. Oh, I can't remember the name of it. I should, but I can't. I just had her on the air a little bit ago. And she had all of her manuscripts in a box, and she had moved to a new apartment after the death of her husband, and the cleaning lady saw all of this box full of junk and old papers and things and thought that she was doing Lucy Freeman a favor and threw all these old manuscripts out.
Oh, Lord.
So Lucy decided that she would start a new career. Rather than be an interior decorator anymore, she would start to write. She remembered her first novel she'd written 25 years ago, never published, but she figured she could revise it a little bit. Went to get it, and it was gone. And she, not very happy with that cleaning lady. She rewrote that novel by memory.
Oh, I'm glad that there was more to the story. I was afraid that was all. So she did rewrite it. Did she find that she was able to remember it as it was?
She so claimed, sold it immediately. It became a bestseller, and I can't remember the title.
That's good news for those of us who lose novels.
Well, tell me about your first novel, The Perfectionist. That, it seemed to me that there must be a lot of autobiographical background.
My, whatever gave you that idea? It's probably my most autobiographical novel because, I was just learning and I wrote very much out of my own experience. But I actually didn't write that novel until I came back to this country. And it was first a story. I thought I would write about this very interesting, short, and probably unsuitable marriage that I had made in England. And so I made it a story. I wrote this story while I was working on the Saturday Evening Post here in New York. And then I sent it to the writer's workshop, and I got in barely by the skin of my teeth.
That was in Iowa?
Mm-hmm. So then I went to Iowa. And I studied with Kurt Vonnegut, and he read that story, and he wrote nice little things in the margin. And I said, well, do you think I should turn it into a novel? And he said, why not? Why don't you try it? So I did. And two or three years later, after many rewrites, Harper and Row took it.
And you had Vonnegut's blessing for that one, huh?
Yes, and he wrote a blurb for the back of it, which was very... I think it would have sold a lot of copies. What was it? A kinky erotic masterpiece, he called it.
Is that what he called it?
Mm-hmm. And my editor said, but there's only, I mean, they only go to bed once and they're married. What's kinky and erotic about it? But,
well, I don't know. It seemed to me that there was this tension between your heroine, the name
was Dane Empson.
Dane. And the little boy.
That's true. I see that now. There was a three-year-old child who never spoke, and she actually spends more time wooing that child than she does her husband.
Yeah, she's picking him up, kissing him, smelling him.
There's smelling him, sniffing
him. This sort of thing. I don't. Uh-huh. Maybe that's where he gets it. It does sound. Maybe it is a kinky erotic novel.
Child abuse or something.
It's not that bad, folks. Were you writing short stories prior to the publication of The Perfectionist?
Yes, I was. And
let me rephrase it. Were you publishing short stories prior to the novel?
No. I was writing them, but actually the first story I ever published did come out about the same time as the novel. So it was I had a fairly late start. I mean, I didn't publish that novel until I was 30.
Was The Perfectionist your thesis?
I used that as my thesis at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. They will let you get a regular PhD in that you have to take comprehensives in some field of literature, But they will let you, if you are a writer of fiction, they will let you use a published novel or a what they deem a publishable novel as your thesis. So I had to have it. It was published by then, and I had to have it all typed out. I had to have, it was like going backwards, regressing. It had to be typed officially like a thesis. And, you know, with the exact title page, just according to the laws of the doctoral thesis.
So it didn't look like a book?
No, it didn't look like a book. It looked like a thesis.
Mm-hmm. What happened, what happened after Iowa? You have your first book published and a whole new future ahead of you. What happened then?
Oh, I went down the road then to Illinois and taught at the University of Illinois for a year. I had a fellowship there. And then Iowa asked me to come back and teach at the workshop, so I went back and taught at the workshop. And then I met a fascinating man, so I moved to New York. And I've been living, well, outside of New York for 10 years.
In Woodstock?
In Woodstock, yes.
I understand that you were working on a novel, I believe it's in the data here, it was called Gotham?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And that was interrupted when you began work on the finish, because of your work on the finishing school. Tell me about that.
Well, I had real serious plans for this novel called Gotham, and it was going to be a late 20th century Vanity Fair. And I had all the characters. I had little notebooks for them with their lives, and because it was going to be a big, big book. It was going to be a kind of a cynical book. I didn't like a lot of the characters. And I had started writing it. I had more than started writing it. I had about 108 and a half pages, to be about exact. And I had a dream.
What?
A dream. You know, at night you have dreams. And I dreamed about, it was just a woman and a young girl, and they were sitting on the threshold of this crumbling hut in the woods, and the woman was talking to the girl, and it started to rain. And I woke up, and I had the first lines of this book in my mind. And so what came first was the image and the feeling. I wanted to write about these people. The thing was that I knew that I was that woman and I was also the girl. It was like splitting into two people. And I wanted to know what we were going to do to each other. So I wrote the book.
You saw yourself as both Ursula and the
and
girl?
Justin. I saw myself as a 44-year-old woman, and I saw myself as a 14-year-old girl. And there they were meeting. And the 44-year-old woman has many things to tell the girl. And I knew that they were going to influence each other's lives. I didn't realize that it would be as tragic as it was. I mean, the girl inadvertently causes, really does ruin the woman's life through being at some place at the wrong time. And through being too obsessed with the woman. You know, she's been following her around. And she, well, I don't want to tell the plot of the book, but... And I didn't know the plot of the book when I had that dream. But then as I began to write it, I understood what I was writing about. I was writing about growing up and about what you have to do to keep from congealing, as Ursula calls it. When you're at some time in your adult life, and maybe sometimes even before, you're in danger of just stopping growing, and that's what that book is really about, among other things.
Did you indicate to me that you did not know how the book would end as you began to write it?
No, I just knew. I mean, these things happen fairly quickly once they start to happen. I mean, your mind is much faster than a computer. As soon as I woke up, wrote the words down, I already knew that the woman lived in this old house, and she lived with her brother. I knew that he was going to be some kind of artist, and then I decided to make him a musician, a failed concert pianist, actually. And And I knew that they had something, there was some secret there in their life. There was something that it wouldn't do well to come out. And I knew that the girl was going to find it. But I didn't know that there would be a reaction even to that. I thought that, the denouement would be that the girl would simply find out some secret. And I didn't know what the secret was. I really did not know.
I'm not going to mention this on my report, but I am still a little bit baffled as to why she jumped into the pond. I don't think that she made it clear. She wasn't going to commit suicide. She expresses that in the book. She obviously had some sort of shock when she found Ursula and Abel.
Yeah.
The farmer. But it's not clear to me exactly why she impulsively did this act.
Well, it's clear to me, but it wasn't when I knew that's what she was going to do. I knew that's what she would do because that's the way she was. What that jump was, it was a dramatic act. Now,
was it a protest?
It was a protest, and it was, haven't you ever done things, you know, maybe very inconvenient to yourself and even dangerous to yourself just to, really, to make a splash. That's what she wanted to do. She wanted to make a splash. And I had all kinds of, when I was working up to this scene, I thought, she's going to discover these two. Now, what is she going to do? What would be psychologically right? And I didn't know until almost the moment. I didn't know if she was going to just scream at them and say something, or just go home and nurse her wounds for years, or what. And then and the other thing that I realized, she had never swum in that pond all summer because of the nasty, creepy, crawly thing she was afraid of. And in making this splash of protest, she was also saying, all right, you've disgusted me so, you've disillusioned me so, I'm going to join all the creepy, crawly things. I'm going to soil myself. It became exactly the right thing for her to do. And yet I didn't know it when I saw her doing it. So in some way, with me, the image often comes a little ahead of why. But I do think it out afterwards because I don't trust all my images. I mean, some of them are a little too exaggerated.
I'm glad you characterized Mott in a better way toward the end. I liked him from the beginning.
He was fun. It's just children are very cruel. You saw when he was adult, he was perfectly all right. I mean, when she was seeing him as an adult, she could see him as a human being. When she was a child, she thought of him as boring. So somewhere early in the book, she says that when she was young, she saw adults either in relation to what they could do for her, or she pitied them because she saw that they had spoiled themselves in some way. And I'm afraid that's the way the young think a lot of the time.
Do you use women as your protagonists in all of your work?
Let's see. In all of my books so far, well, there are some strong male characters in A Mother and Two Daughters. I do think that in The Perfectionist that the husband is equally compelling in his way. I mean, that's a novel about a sort of balance or imbalance. This novel, The Finishing School, is mostly about these two women. I mean, the woman and the girl, and the men who surround them. Two or three of those men are, well, they're not strong, but I would say Abel, the horse trainer, horse breeder, is a strong man. Well, Mott is strong in his way. He's just shy and loyal.
Yeah, but the books aren't really centered around the male characters.
No, they're not centered around the male characters.
You've done that with the women. The adjustment of the Stokes family to the North, did that reflect some of your own adjustments as a person from the South moving to the North, and indeed when you went to Europe?
Let me think. I didn't leave the South until I was 22 or 23. I've spoken to many Southern transplants, people who live up here now, and we sometimes talk about, there are differences. Some of them are subtle differences in temperament. It depends on where you move too. I mean, if you move to Vermont, you're going to get one kind of change. If you move to upstate New York, you get another one. If you move to New Jersey, you'll get another one. Yes, and I've known some children who have been moved from the South to the North and from the North to the South. Now, some people who read that book say they have moved from the North to the South, and they felt some of the same things that Justin felt, only naturally their specifics would be different ones.
How do we characterize you? Are you a Southern novelist? Or are you just a novelist? Or how do we... Can we pigeonhole you in any way?
I can't keep people from pigeonholing me, and I've been called a Southern novelist, a woman novelist, what else? Well, that's all I've been called.
Thank goodness. Are you still teaching?
No, I'm not. I'm just writing at the moment. I'm working on a long book.
Did you go back to Gotham?
Which will have, no, I trashed poor Gotham. But my new book will have a major male character. You'll be glad to hear. I hope you'll be glad to hear.
Well, I'll certainly be looking forward to reading that. Kurt Vonnegut still a mentor to you?
He's very much of a, well, I'm brave enough now to think of him as a friend. He was a mentor. We all looked up to him so much. And now, and he's also a legend, I think. He's a legend, a friend. He's someone who reads my books, which is wonderful. I read his books. And
I admire Kurt Vonnegut because I read him when I was a teenager, when I was addicted to science fiction, as teenagers mm-hmm. usually are, teenagers. Mostly male teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
So I even have a copy, a Doubleday Book Club copy of his first book, Player Piano.
Oh, you have?
Yeah, which I've carted around with me year after year. I've had Vonnegut in, and we've talked a couple of times. I understand you were in the same class with John Irving?
Iowa? Yes, we were in the same class, and then we went back at the same time to teach for a year. So we were students together, and then we went back and were teachers in 1972.
I met John Irving once. I understand he's coming out with a new novel within a year, and I'd like very much to talk to him.
It's in June, yeah.
Is it June?
June 17th is the publication date.
Gail Godwin, and I'm pronouncing it correctly. It is Godwin, not Goodwin.
It's Godwin. Thank you for pronouncing it right.
I probably would have said it wrong if I hadn't have asked.
It means friend of God in Anglo-Saxon.
Do you get back to the South a lot?
I try to. My mother still lives there. I have a sister and a brother and a friend and some animals that I like. So I do try to get home at least three times a year.
Oh, I should ask you one other thing. This is only very coherent interview, but I'll make sense out of it.
This sounds good. You ought to leave a little of this stuff in.
I should have asked you. I always ask my guests, how do you work as a writer? Obviously, you must have a specific place that you go to, and, what kind of working habits do you have?
Well, I'm a morning person, and I don't work for many hours. I do intense work for about 2 hours, and that's really all. But the thing about that is that I'm thinking about it all day. I'm living in a book from the time I think about beginning it till the time it's finished. So, I sometimes dream about it, then I get up and have a cup of coffee and go up to my study and write whatever I'm going to write that day. I mean, it varies, but usually it's a couple of pages. And then I'm done. I take off and I go swimming. And then I usually come home and maybe make some notes in a journal about what I hope to do the next day. And then that's all until the next day.
Well, how is it... being so far out in the country, Vonnegut told me that he moved to New York from Cape Cod because he needed to hear the sounds of the city and the vibrance of the city, and it just got too quiet and too dull on Cape Cod and the same people all the time.
Well, I like to hear the noise in the country. There's the crows and the skunks. We have some skunks who live in our basement, and they're certainly not quiet. And the deer, they come knocking against the window at night. It's plenty loud. The birds are loud.
Well, I don't mean in terms of noise, but just Updike was telling me that when he was here, when his novel, The Witches of Ipswich, mm-hmm. came out, that just walking along the streets of New York, he could see 100 stories that he could take back with him. Some just things people wear, for example.
That's true. I come to New York every other week or so, and I see plenty, I mean enough to... really to furnish me with more stories than I need. But I find the tempo of life in the country and the way it affects my spirit just suits me better. I have more time to go down deep and submerge rather than being on the surface looking to the right and the left, holding my pocketbook close. It's a different way of moving through life. But I need both, of course.
How'd the Today Show go? Well, the Today Show last
night? It went fine. I wouldn't believe anybody until I actually saw it myself, but some nice friend made me a copy of it. So I saw it, and I didn't disgrace myself.
When Updike was here, he came over after an appearance on the CBS Morning News. But they had flown him in. I got a call the night before at my home from the publicist at Knopf. And they told me that an opening had come up on the CBS Morning News with Diane Sawyer.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to fly up like in from Boston just to be on my little radio show, but something on national TV like that, live, they decided that would be okay.
Uh-huh.
And asked if I would like to piggyback. You know, they bring Updike over here as soon as he finished the broadcast. So I asked Updike, what did they ask you? Updike said, well, Diane Sawyer, first question was, what do women want from men?
Oh, to be asked that in the morning. What did he answer?
He couldn't remember. I said, well, how did you answer a question like that? He said, I must have made a fool out of myself. He stutters a little bit. I must have made a fool out of myself. I couldn't think of anything to say. What kind of question was that? So.
Well, you know, you do worry. The first time I went on the Today Show with the last book, A Mother and Two Daughters, I sat up all night preparing as if I were preparing for my PhD comprehensives. I was preparing for some question like, well, what is the meaning of this book, or how do the themes relate to so-and-so? And I was just terrified that I might not be able to answer a question about my own book, and that would be shocking. But it just went so quickly. You know, you only have 3 minutes, but you have all that time to worry beforehand.
They probably ask you more about yourself.
They do, but this time she asked real good questions about the book, Jane Pauley, and she asked about, you know, how I had the idea for it, and last time she asked, didn't I worry that a title like A Mother and Two Daughters would make people say, yuck, a woman's book, and I did think quickly that there was a book called Father and Sons, and Fathers and Sons, and nobody said yuck a man's book.
Or Sons and Lovers.
Or Sons and Lovers. Well, though, that's sort of yuck a... lovers can be either sex. But you have to have your wits about you, and one always worries that it'll be that kind of morning when you won't have them.
Well, I've seen people come in with all sorts of notes. I make notes in order to keep the... so I know what I'm going to ask, but not mm-hmm. a lot of gaps and pauses and things.
Oh, people bring in notes?
Oh, I've seen people come in with stacks of
maybe
notes. It doesn't work.
It doesn't, because you can't find anything.
Oh,
you hear it flipping through the microphone.
I really appreciate you coming in and talking to me.